Welcome to second day with presentations here at Born Hack. I would like to welcome Mark-Jan Bastian and your talk about power supply, stability and risks.
Yes, thank you. Well, welcome everybody. This talk, my name is Mark Bastian, and the presentation is called Power Supply, Stability and Risks. For a very quick thing, which I will discuss in this presentation, is always verify the operational life of your electrolytic capacitors. Perform stability tests for load step up and step down. You can do that, for example, with electronic load. Repeat that for every new batch of hardware, because you never know which kind of chips end up in your supply chain, especially with in these days where there's a lot of scarcity of chips. And the design time, there's a few things which you can do. The power supply of the control signals of in your power source, feedback loops. That's a very academic topic, but I will just do it very practically, which things in practice can go wrong. And also just verify the soft start function during powering up of your circuit. So that's the main thing. The main tool that which I use, this is actually DC electronic load. It was actually relatively cheap. I mean, it used to be many hundreds of euros, but about a year ago I found this Chinese version. It's a Chinese power electronic load with 400 watts of dissipation, 150 volts. So this should be reasonable for any power supply like audio amplifier and that kind of stuff. So it was a pretty good deal. I got a bit weird things when I was ordering it, because somebody mentioned that there could be a back door into in this power supply. I mean, that was very interesting, and I definitely want that. So I bought two of them. I mean, how can you have a backdoor in an electronic load? That was definitely want to check that out. There's RS2D 3D2 port, actually serial port on the back, which you can use to control it. That was a very weird story. But you can just use it with the buttons and just verify all the results with your scope. All the time domains are not interconnected, and the only way they talk to each other is via the line they share. So I don't see any way to make a backdoor in an electronic load, but you could maybe make a backdoor in a power supply to actually have it fail at some point. So, and that's where this talk is about. Maybe one of the things that you might be familiar with, in 2015 there was a user on the Raspberry Pi forum that actually found out that if he made a Xenon flash of his Raspberry Pi board, the power supply crashed. And he actually fixed it by putting a piece of blue tech on his Raspberry Pi. That was actually very interesting, of course. That looks like an attack on the power supply. And that was actually due to the power controller itself. It was kind of transparent for the wavelength of Xenon, and actually caused a glitch, which caused a power outage in the Raspberry Pi, and then caused a reset. So that was quite interesting, but relatively easy to fix. We'll go into the several power supply circuits that you can find on any board, or if you design your own board. Most common already since the 70s, or maybe even earlier, is a linear regulator, which is basically a transistor which controls the current from V in to V out, and all power, all the voltage difference is actually dissipated in that transistor. So it's not very efficient. So you actually, if you would do this on a battery power thing, and you have a very big difference between your battery voltage and the usable voltage, then you waste a lot of power, and that is of course not good for your battery life. So the idea is to always use a way to do DC-DC conversion with a high efficiency, and the efficiency should be above 70%, or in some cases even up 79 to 98%. There are actually regulators which are capable of doing that on reasonably high power levels. The most common conversion you will find in mobile phones and battery powered stuff is buck converters, and this is basically a DC-DC converter where you're having an inductor and a capacitor. The inductor is usually around 1 to 10 microhenry, so it's relatively small, and it should have a decent DC carrying capability, like a few amps. An output capacitor is usually a ceramic capacitor because, well, they're having low, very low ESR, so series resistance, and that makes it's both a storage, and you can also see it as an LC filter that filters out all the switching noise, because the power will be generated by using two switches. There's a high side switch and a low side switch, and the high side switch is used to actually put a jolt of current into the inductor. The inductor will get a triangular voltage over it, and then the Vout itself will be stable and depends on the duty cycle you apply to the top switch. There's also a switch here on the bottom. That's not strictly needed for all converters, but you can use that to actually make the converter a little bit more efficient, because there's a voltage drop over here and dissipation, and if you use a MOSFET here, then you have less voltage drop there, you can having a little bit better regulation. So for all the high power scenarios, usually it's they're using both switches. This is then a picture from Wikipedia about how such a buck converter works. So you see a relatively short on time, relatively long off time. You see here the input voltage and the voltage over the inductor here. This yellow area, which is both positive and negative, if you measure it over the inductor, and the output voltage is relatively constant, and that's in continuous mode. And if you do not have too much load, then you might be in discontinuous mode, and then it looks a little bit different, and you see there's a dead time where there's no voltage drop over the inductor. This is all ideal, but inductors are not ideal. This is just a concept. If you implement this in a chip, then you want to actually put all the semiconductors in one chip. If you put all the transistors and the diode and everything in one chip, and only have the external components of inductor and capacitor on the output, it's relatively simple. You can then use a p-channel MOSFET on the top. And you put a negative, you have to pull the signal down to turn the switch on, and it will do that with a certain with PWM, and there will be control circuits also integrated in the chip, which takes the feedback output, and then this is relatively simple and cheap. But if you want to make a little bit more higher power scenario, then you're using n-channel MOSFETs. And the reason why you want to use n-channel MOSFETs is because, they have usually better specifications than p-channel MOSFETs, for a lower RDS on, higher current capability. And you can also sometimes use them as external components. So if you have a separate n-channel MOSFETs external to your regulator, you can then draw much more power, because you can optimize your control logic to which you just being gate drivers for external MOSFETs, and external MOSFETs put on the board, and even put heat sinks on them to actually make it even more simple. There's a difference, because with n-channel MOSFETs you need a positive voltage to turn them on, and that creates a problem. On the bottom side, that's usually not a problem, because your VIN is probably higher than 3 volts, and 3 volts is usually a kind of threshold for high power MOSFETs. And for the top side, if this MOSFET needs to be turned on, then you also need more than 3 volts over here. But if your input voltage is, when this thing is on, there will be almost no voltage drop between the drain and the source. So you need gate voltage needs to be above VIN. So that's an interesting problem, and you have to solve that problem somehow. You could do that by actually making voltage internal using a charge pump or something like that in your chip. Those charge pumps need capacitors. The capacitors are very expensive in a chip. You cannot get more than a few picofarads in a chip, or even less. What the chip designers do, they give you a boost input, and then you have to put an external capacitor which is connected to the switching node, And this will be basically get a kind of square wave on this node due to this thing switching. Initially, the gate might be not be very good conducting, but as soon as you got a few cycles, you actually power the charge pump here inside the chip, and then your power gets more stable. And sometimes you can also help that charge pump by actually providing external diode. And that's sometimes very handy. So also some power supply manufacturers provide application notes how to do that. And that's, yeah, that's yeah, you should really always check if there are application notes for the chip that you picked. Because, if you forget that, there might be some issues if you do not provide the power here quick enough. Well, what's more? This is the most important part, I think, for this part. What you also see, there's always body diodes inside all the MOSFETs. I always put them in my schematics because it makes swapping drain and source on the MOSFET in the schematic is very disastrous. You don't want to do that. And it's also a bit more logical because if you reverse power or anything or you have some back EMF, you can just trace the path the current goes. Then there's another thing about feedback loop stability. There's a voltage divider usually on the output, and then so if you output to say 3 volts or 3.3 volts, then there's a voltage divider with maybe a few hundred kiloamps drawing a few microamps or less, and then you're having a output voltage which is typically around 1.2 or 0.8 or 0.6 volts or something like that. And then there's a feedback input on the controller of your power supply, and there will be a comparator which compares that output voltage and uses that to adjust the PWM rate of both MOSFETs just to make sure you actually gain the output voltage. There's also some there's also filter response. There's a delay in there. Usually the data sheet will tell you how to calculate it. Well, you have to very carefully always check if you're doing that right. But might be also some issues with the speed of which this feedback loop works. Because if you're, for example, having an output and you put a very quick load step on it, well, you can, for example, generate that with an electronic load, and you actually go from 10% of your current to say 90% of your current, then there might be some oscillations into the control loop which actually eventually crash your power supply. And if you just run normal software on it and it seems to work, then yeah, you think, well, everything is fine, yeah, well, let's just ship it. But it's important to actually just do the extra step, use an electronic load to do this step response from 10% to 90%, but also from 90% to 10%. Because that creates additional capacitance and then creates more delay times. That could also cause issues. This is a very practical thing, very simple to do, and it works irrespective of your data sheet. So if you bought a component and you see, it should work because it's pin compatible, and you found the data sheet and everything seemed to work, but if you just perform this practical test, it's very easy to verify whether you actually made the right choice. But also, there might be issues with the current through this feedback resistor. So some data sheets of some regulators, they also say that you have to add an additional capacitor. So you see the green capacitor over there, and that actually creates, actually enhances the performance of the output to the feedback. And so if there's additional capacitance here, or some input load, then that capacitor could be only a few hundred picofarads, actually improves the response of the feedback loop. So if you see issues, just experiment with those capacitor values to see if your step response improves. This is basically all the most important parts. It's a very relatively simple and a quick thing. So these are all the things: verified operational operational life for electrolytic capacitors, Well, that's because the if your capacitors dry out, they usually the ESR actually goes up, and it means that the capacitor is doing its work less and will dissipate more and more power. So they get hotter, they will evaporate their electrolyte much faster. So if you have old consumer hardware, the easiest way to repair it is just verify, desolder the electric capacitors, verify their impedance using an LCR meter, and then see if that's still within spec, and otherwise find other capacitors to replace them with. Well, the load step up and step down, so there's 10% to 80-90% of your current. Yeah, and if you have new batches of hardware, well, you could there could be new chips in your thing, in your hardware supply chain. So always just check. Well, if you have new hardware or new reel of components coming in, just verify a hardware and also the power supplies. Well, the driving control electronics power source basically, well, it's the bootstrap capacitor story that I just told. The feedback loop, that's the small capacitor on the voltage divider. Yeah, the ringing itself, that's, yeah, you can see just what looks best. I mean, if it goes up and then there's a lot of things ringing before it becomes stable, yeah, that might be getting problematic if the transient becomes even sharper. So, yeah, it's best to just make it fast and smooth. Oh yeah, and the soft start function power up time. So yeah, if you power up your circuit for the first time, you might have several regulators in series. So if you have a 230 volt SMPS, and that provides a voltage ramp, and then after that you have a few other regulators in series. Well, if one of those regulators starts restarting or rebooting, yeah, eventually it might get stable, but yeah, it's a bit of messy and it will increase your debug time. So if you just do it in sequence, all the power supplies, and making sure it's fast and reliable, that saves a lot of debugging for the electronic part. So well, this was my talk. So hopefully, well, maybe there are some questions or other things. Otherwise, can do some more experiments.
Any questions? No? Then, thank you.
Yeah.